This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk. My guest is Bill McKibben, educator, environmental activist, and author of more than a dozen books. His newest title is The Flag, The Cross, and The Station Wagon. A graying American looks back at his suburban boyhood and wonders, what the hell happened? He's Zooming with me today from his home in Vermont. Bill, welcome to Book Talk.
Well, what a pleasure to get to join you, Diana.
You've said, I'm curious about what went so suddenly sour with American patriotism, American faith, and American prosperity. I got to say, I wondered too, which loss came first, or did it all happen at the same time?
Well, I think there were a lot of things going on, and I think that they followed a similar track. You know, to those of us who grew up in what seemed like the modest paradise of American suburbia in the 60s or 70s, it was easy to imagine that things would just continue along the same track. And then they did. And I think if you had to name one thing, Diana, it would be the fact that we got away from the social solidarity that had marked the years after the Depression and the Second World War and replaced them with a kind of hyper-individualism, maybe most powerfully represented by the election of Ronald Reagan and his insistence that government was the problem and that markets solved all issues and so on. But, you know, also those were the years of the tax revolts, California's Proposition 13, the idea that it was too much to ask that we help take care of each other. And I have a feeling that's where things really broke down, and we've been playing out ever since the almost inevitable consequences of those decisions. And you can now watch Joe Biden struggling to try and bring back a little bit of that sense of solidarity and common purpose. But my, it's very hard once it gets broken.
Your memoir, in great part, is a memoir of Lexington, Massachusetts. Why did you include so much about your hometown?
Well, Lexington's an interesting place because it's self-styled the birthplace of American liberty and the site of the first battle of the American Revolution, and more or less the site of the first battle against what we might now call colonialism or imperialism, against the biggest empire in the world. And so it has a proud history and an interesting one. It allowed me to write a lot about American history and how we understand it now and how we're coming to understand it differently. You know, one of the things I've found out in the course of writing this that kind of blew my mind, actually, was I was reading back about Paul Revere's famous ride when he rode out to Lexington to inform the colonists that the British were coming. And in his account of that, his own account of that, he describes going past the common in the town of Charlestown. He said, I took a turn left right where Mark's body was hanging. And I had no idea what he was referring to, so I did some research to find out that Mark had been a slave held in Massachusetts 20 years prior, who had killed his very cruel master, and for that crime was convicted not of murder but of high treason and gibbeted, that is, hung in an iron cage for his body there to rot, and it had stayed for decades. It had become a landmark, as it were, that Revere knew everybody would know what he was talking about. And I have to say that started recasting my sense of Massachusetts and New England in the Revolution. I'd been a tour guide as a young man on the Battle Green in Lexington showing people around. But man, that helped me understand more powerfully some of the moments in American history that we have to make up for, some of the debts that have yet to be paid. So that really reshaped my thinking a little bit about that first battle in Lexington. I'd been a tour guide on the Green for many years growing up and telling a very patriotic story, but now the darker side of that story became more clear, and with it a sense of the kind of debts owed, debts that in places like Lexington were also very modern. I mean, when I was 10, the town of Lexington took a townwide referendum on whether or not to have affordable housing, what was a almost completely white community, and voted down almost 2-1 plans for even a very modest development of affordable homes. Lexington remains, you know, its black population is smaller now than it was in 1970. So these shadows are very real, and the things we need to write and think about and act on as soon as we can.
Why do you see individualism as a problem in the country today?
Well, it's not individualism. Individualism's fine. It's the kind of hyper-individualism that overtook us and made it very difficult for us to do the things that are required of a society. I think we got a sense of that in the pandemic, I fear, when so many people were unwilling to cooperate with those around them. You know, Ronald Reagan's famous laugh line in his speeches for many years was he would say, well, the 9 scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. You know, ha, ha, ha. Turns out the scariest words in the English language are, we've run out of ventilators. Or, and this will be appropriate for people in your town of Boulder, the hillside behind your house just caught on fire. And these are not things that we can solve, deal with at all as individuals. They require that we work together. And that working together is something we're not so good at anymore in this society. Our politics have become bizarrely dysfunctional. It's every man for himself, and it's not working out that well.
In 70, when your family moved to Massachusetts, 97% of Americans believed in God in a Gallup poll. By 2021, that number dropped to 47%. What happened?
Well, I mean, many things happened, but it may also be part of that trend towards a kind of hyper-individualism in each of us deciding that we were fine on our own and figuring out those kind of questions. In some ways, the most dramatic change was in the composition of our religious life. 50 years ago, the majority of Americans belonged to what we call the mainline Protestant denominations, Presbyterianism, Lutheranism, Methodism, which is what I am, Congregationalist, so on. That's now about 15% of the population. And the Christians that remain are more likely to be right-wing evangelical or fundamentalist. And those are religious traditions that emphasize one-on-one personal relationship with God, not the kind of communal experience that these older traditions emphasized. So even within those who remain Christian, the world has shifted in some fairly profound ways.
What are some of the reasons for being optimistic about the future of the USA?
Well, to be optimistic about the future, one would note that young people are doing a tremendous job of showing up and working for things that count. We've seen the Sunrise Movement, these wonderful young people who brought us the idea of the Green New Deal. And we've seen even younger children, the kind of colleagues of Greta Thunberg across our nation who have been standing up for action on climate and on racial justice and on other issues. And so if you wanted to be optimistic, that's where you'd look. But it's not enough to kind of be hopeful. We need to very actively support and nurture that work because we don't have much time left, especially on climate change, which is a time test. If we don't get it right soon, we'll never get it right. So it really couldn't be more important to try and make hope real in these next few years. Hence the organizing we're doing at Third Act. We need older people backing up younger people if we're going to get where we need to get.
Thank you. My guest is Bill McKibben, author of The Flag, The Cross, and The Station Wagon, A Graying American Looks Back at His Suburban Boyhood and Wonders What the Hell Happened, published by Henry Holt. This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk.
Thank you, Diana. All right. God bless.